Charles Spurgeon, the Puritan Prince of Preachers. And Charles Spurgeon really stands out. In an age of great preachers, the greatest of them was Charles Haddon Spurgeon, and that is the verdict across the board. He was born and he was raised in Essex, in a rural area, in a very, very small village. Charles Spurgeon came from a line of solid dissenting ancestors. Now, in England, dissenting means you weren't part of the state church. Their family were Congregationalists. They were not part of the state church of England, and for that reason, they were called dissenters. And of course, remember, going all the way back to Bloody Mary, dissenters got burned at the stake. Whereas under Charles I, they only had their noses slit and their ears cut off and their faces branded. And under Charles II, they were banished from cities and towns and locked in prison like John Bunyan, for example. But his father and his grandfather were both independent congregational ministers. Charles was born in 1834 in Kelvedon, Essex, an area which had a long tradition of Protestant resistance to Catholicism, dating back to the persecutions of Bloody Mary in the 16th century, and Essex was always an absolute thorn in the side, a dagger in the side of the Catholics, because they were so solidly Protestant, so solidly in support of the Roundheads and part of the army, the Ironsides of Oliver Cromwell. He was a son of the manse, and this is in fact the manse where he was brought up in his grandfather's home, because his earliest childhood memories were of listening to sermons, learning hymns, and looking at the pictures in the Pilgrim's Progress and in Fox's Book of Martyrs, two of the most well-illustrated books of their time. And Charles first read Pilgrim's Progress at age six, read it on his own, and he went on to read it, he said, over 100 times in his life. Pilgrim's Progress and Fox's Book of Martyrs dominated his way of thinking and his theology. He would later recommend Fox's Book of Martyrs as the perfect Christmas gift for a child. He regarded Fox's Book of Martyrs as one of the most significant books he ever read. He said it vividly shaped his attitudes towards established religions, towards the tyranny of Rome and the glory of the Reformation. His childhood heroes were the brave Protestants who were burned alive at Smithfield and the valiant Puritans like John Bunyan, who were jailed for their faith. Because his parents were destitute, during his formative years, Charles was actually raised by his grandparents. At age seven, though, his father got a better pastorate, and so he was able to return to his parents' home where his mother lovingly taught him the scriptures. But Charles's mother had 17 children, nine of whom died in infancy. So here's one of the only eight survivors of 17. Well, when he is young, there was a prophetic word. Now, this is where his grandfather actually ministered, and that's his congregation in Stanbourne. His grandfather, I should say, was at Stanbourne, but his father was the pastor at Tollesbury in Essex. When Charles was only 10 years old, there was a visiting missionary who had ministered all over the world, even as far as China, and Reverend Richard Kinnell had come to preach at Stanbourne at the invitation of Reverend John Spurgeon, the grandfather. And he was struck by how young Charles read the Bible with such emphasis. And after breakfast, he walked in the garden with Charles, speaking of the Lord in his service. Now remember, Charles is only 10 years old here. And they knelt together in the garden, and Pastor Kinnell poured out a vibrant, earnest, intercessory prayer on behalf of young Charles. And before leaving the manse, Richard Kinnell called the whole family together, drew Charles to his knee and said, "I do not know how, but I feel a solemn presentiment that this child will preach the gospel to thousands, and God will bless him to many souls. So sure am I of this that when my little man preaches in Surrey Music Hall, as he will do one day, I should like him to promise me that he will give out the hymn commencing, 'God moves in a mysterious way, his wonders to perform.'" And this was fulfilled in 1856 when Charles was only 21 years old. This is amazing. Now, at that time, Surrey Music Hall was the biggest auditorium you could have in England, and that was London. After that, after this time, they built the Crystal Palace, which could accommodate more, and Charles Spurgeon preached there too. But he thought of Surrey Music Hall because that was the largest place that anyone could possibly meet. Not that that was used for evangelistic meetings at that stage. This is a real prophetic word, an amazing foretelling of what was coming. And this is the review of the meeting house that his grandfather preached at in Stanbourne. And this was the St. Augustine's College in Maidstone, where Spurgeon went to school, his only formal schooling, for 2 years, in 1848 to 1849. Reverend John Spurgeon, his grandfather, was very devoted to his grandson Charles. It was his custom to allow Charles to read the scriptures at family worship. And visitors commented on the skill with which the young man read with such emphasis and unerring correctness, and how he emphasized the right points. His grandfather related the story that when Charles was only 6 years old, he overheard his grandfather deploring the drinking habits of one of his congregation, who frequented the local pub. So young Charles declared, "I will kill him!" And shortly afterwards he informed his grandfather that he had killed old Rhodes. "He will never grieve my poor grandfather anymore." "What do you mean?" my child asked the grandfather. "I've been about the Lord's work," declared young Charles. And his grandfather soon solved the mystery when Rhodes himself explained to him that Charles had come to him in the public house, meaning the pub. Declared, "What doest thou here, sitting with the ungodly? You a member of a church and break your pastor's heart? I am ashamed of you." Now the man was angry for a moment. And then he came to the conviction that this young child was right, and he determined to repent and never again to return to drink at the tavern. And he came and he gave that story and solved the mystery. Well, the conversion to Charles happened at age 15. Now, his formal education was very minimal, but he had devoured his grandfather's Puritan books, and he was well-read. And he attended a local school for a few brief years, and then for a brief time he was an usher, which is a teaching assistant at an Anglican school in Newmarket. But in 1849, when he was 15 years old, under conviction of sin, anxious to know forgiveness, he was obliged to stop on the road due to a snowstorm. And he found himself in a primitive Methodist chapel in Colchester. And as the service progressed, it appeared that the minister would not arrive, probably due to the snowstorm. And at last, a very thin deacon came into the pulpit, and he opened up his Bible and he read, "Look unto me, and be ye saved, all the ends of the earth." And then apparently looking straight at Charles Spurgeon, he declared, "Young man, you are in trouble. You will never get out of it until you look to Christ." And then he lifted up his hand and he explained repeatedly, "Look, look, look." And Spurgeon later wrote, "I had been waiting to do 50 things. But when I heard this word, look, what a charming word it seemed to me. Oh, I looked until I could almost have looked my eyes away. And in heaven I will look on still in joy unutterable." Mm-hmm. He later wrote of his day of his conversion, "And as the snow fell on the road home from that little house of prayer, I thought that every snowflake talked with me and told me of the pardon I'd found, for I was white as the driven snow through the grace of God." And upon his return home, his appearance caused his mother to exclaim, "Something wonderful has happened to you." Well, this is the ferry where he was baptized. And he was actually baptized in the River Lock. "For several months he searched the scriptures to know more fully the value of the jewel which God had given me, and he found that believers ought to be baptized. So 4 months after his conversion, he is baptized by immersion in the River Lock." And this is May 1850. "And he vowed to spend his life in extension of Christ's cause in whatever way he pleases." Now his mother had often prayed, "Oh, that my son might live for thee." However, she is shocked in what appeared to be youthful rebellion when Charles broke with the congregational tradition of his family and was baptized by full immersion in the River Lock. And then he joined a Baptist church. So his mother exclaimed, "Charlie, I've often prayed that you might be saved, but never that you should become a Baptist." To this Charles replied, "God has answered your prayer, mother, with his usual bounty and has given me more than you asked." Well, this is the cottage in which he first preached the gospel. Charles preached his first sermon at age 16. Now, he's converted at age 15, he's preaching at age 16. And it was before a small congregation of farm labourers and their wives in a thatched chapel here at, well, first at Tavisham. And then he moved to school in Cambridge and joined St. Andrew Street Baptist Church and became a village preacher. And then Waterbeach Baptist Church, that's this congregation depicted here, invited him to become their pastor. Now his very youthful appearance was in stonking contrast to the maturity of his sermons, because he was an heir to the Puritans. This, by the way, is in his own book, a picture that he took in Calvin's Cathedral, St. Peter's in Geneva. And he truly was an heir to the Puritans. All the great Puritan books that he had devoured in his grandfather's house came to the fore. He had a retentive memory. He had youthful energy. He had great oratorical skills. And this made such an impact that people travelled to hear this boy preacher. Within 18 months, his reputation had spread to London, and he was invited to preach at the historic New Park Street Chapel, which was long connected with the Puritans, going way back into the times of Oliver Cromwell and the independence back in the days of the English Civil War. Now, London was in a great time of crisis when he was invited to come there. He was only 19 years old when he began his pastorate at the famous but rundown New Park Street Baptist Church in Newark. It was March 1854 when Spurgeon began his ministry in London. It was a time of tremendous economic and social upheaval. A plague of cholera hit London that same year, 1854, and 20,000 people died just in London due to this epidemic. And can you imagine the impact that would have? Also in that same year, the Crimean War broke out, the first war involving the major European powers since the Battle of Waterloo in 1815 that ended the Napoleonic Wars. This is a time of great stress. And this is followed by the Indian Mutiny of 1857, which provoked such a tremendous outpouring of grief and rage, leading to a national day of fasting and humiliation, during which Charles Spurgeon was invited to address the largest audience of his life, which was almost 24,000 people gathered in the Crystal Palace, which had only been set up the year before. The disruptions and economic hardships caused by the American Civil War in the 1860s put many people out of work, brought suffering and economic ruin to a lot of people in England. And so he was in the greatest city of the greatest empire of the world at a time of great crisis. And you can just see God's timing in this. Now, he was a Calvinist evangelist, and here is a facsimile of a Calvin medal presented to Spurgeon during his visit to Geneva, his pilgrimage to Geneva. Very conscious of his youth and of his inexperience, Charles Spurgeon prayed that these may not hinder my usefulness. Charles Spurgeon deliberately built upon the Calvinist teachings and Puritan devotion of George Whitfield, and he soon became the most popular preacher in London. Now remember, George Whitfield was the boy preacher. He was incredibly young when God called him and used him, and he was also an heir to the Puritans. So you can see a real direct line between George Whitfield and Spurgeon, although Spurgeon was more stable as a pastor, whereas Whitfield was very itinerant as an evangelist. But yet you can see a lot of similarities between them, certainly in their faith. When Spurgeon arrived at New Park Street Baptist Church, the congregation had 232 members, but there were only 80 in attendance at that first sermon. By the end of his pastorate, 38 years later, the membership had increased to 5,311. Altogether, 14,460 people were added to the congregation during Spurgeon's 38 years pastorate. He built New Park into the largest independent congregation in the world. Before the age of mega churches, he showed the way. If only they would stick with the stability he had. Now, coinciding with such tumultuous international events and domestic distress in the greatest city in the world at that time, and this is a contemporary portrait of the Crystal Cathedral at that time. You just see how advanced this was. London was the scene of the first international trade fair, and this is the height of the Industrial Revolution, and this is the time of Dickens, and this is the time of Florence Nightingale and David Livingstone. So he's right there at the heart of the great empire at the great time of history. And soon, you can imagine how his ministry is attracting such excitement and attention, and it was soon necessary to extend the premises, and for 3 months the church met at Exeter Hall in the Strand, with crowds filling all 4,500 seats each Sunday. And then the meetings were switched to the Music Hall in Surrey Gardens, while the possibility of building new church premises was being discussed. Now, this is how the London Times depicted it, that while the old state church people were riding some horse cart, there was Spurgeon riding the new locomotive. He was taking modern technology and going ahead with it. Spurgeon was described as compelling, charismatic, a speaker dramatic to his fingertips. He frequently acted the parts in biblical stories. He paced the platform. He even ran from side to side, and his sermons were filled with heart-rending stories that ordinary people could relate to, of dying children, grieving parents, repentant harlots, and servants wiser than their masters. Spurgeon's language was graphic, emotionally charged, and compelling. The dramatic devices that he employed have now become pretty commonplace, but they were quite shocking for mid-Victorian years. His many critics roundly condemned the young minister's style, his manners, and his appearance, and many ministers were openly contemptuous of his sensationalism, although it was later pointed out that many of these same critics came to copy his styles and even appropriate his sermons. Now, Spurgeon had a model marriage. In 1856, he married Susanna Thompson, a member of his congregation, a daughter of a prosperous ribbon manufacturer. She was described as trim, pretty, and stylishly dressed. And by her account, it was not love at first sight. She was highly critical of this young preacher's style. However, he was a persistent suitor, and he took her repeatedly to the Crystal Palace, the gardens there, and that was where he sought to court her. By all accounts, the marriage was a very loving one and a source of strength and comfort to them both, although they both suffered from periodic illness and invalidism towards later years. Within the year of their marriage, they were parents of twin boys, Charles and Thomas, and both these grew up to be preachers. And Thomas succeeded his father as the pastor of the Metropolitan Tabernacle, and Charles Jr. took charge of the orphanage that his father had founded, and this was their initial home in London. Now, this picture here, "We Preach Christ Crucified," shows Charles Spurgeon in the center of a host of other witnesses, company of those. Great was the company of those who published it. The Lord gave the word. Great was the company of those who published it. And you can see here, if you look carefully, all kinds of people from Isaac Watts and all the key Puritans. And you can see Owen and there's, of course, Huss, and there's David Livingstone. And you can see Huss and Wycliffe up there. And all of these people are famous Puritans and reformers who preached the word. And somebody produced this early on in his ministry and identified him as the heir to the Puritans, because he was preaching their message so faithfully. On the evening of the 19th of October, 1856, Charles Spurgeon was to commence weekly services at the Royal Surrey Gardens Music Hall. That morning he preached a New Park Street Chapel on Malachi 3, verse 10. "Prove me now," he declared, "I may be called to stand where the thunder clouds brew, where the lightnings play, and tempestuous winds are howling on the mountaintop. Well then, I am born to prove the power and majesty of our God. Amidst dangers, he will inspire me with courage. Amidst toils, he will make me strong. We shall be gathered together tonight where an unprecedented mass of people will assemble, perhaps from idle curiosity, to hear God's word. And a voice cries in my ears, 'Prove me now.'" But then tragedy struck. Here we see Spurgeon preaching at Exeter Hall in 1855. But that evening, Surrey Hall, designed to hold up to 12,000 people, was overflowing with over 22,000 people. The service was underway when, during Spurgeon's prayer, several malicious individuals shouted, "Fire! The galleries are giving way! Fire!" And in the ensuing panic, seven people were trampled to death, 28 were hospitalized from the stampede to evacuate the building. And this tragedy almost ended Spurgeon's ministry. He had to be carried from the pulpit to a friend's house, where he remained for several days in deep, dark depression. He later remarked, "Perhaps never a soul went so near the burning furnace of insanity, and yet came away unharmed." Spurgeon later said that the false fire threat at Surrey Gardens was sufficient to shatter my reason and silence my ministry forever. There's a picture of his cat, Dick.
Oh, in his, he must have been a good man.
Yes, he was. That's in his own book of his family. Shortly after this, Spurgeon had his first episode of incapacitating illness, and he frequently suffered from depression. As he once commented, "Despondency is not a virtue. I believe it is a vice, and I'm heartily ashamed of myself for falling into it." That's just one weakness and failing he had, was depression and physical ailments. Well, this is the first design of the Metropolitan Tabernacle. You'll notice the Greek style, because Spurgeon insisted that, breaking with all previous traditions, he wanted church to be built in Greek style, because the New Testament was conveyed in the Greek language, and therefore he wanted the church to depict the apostolic origins of the New Testament origins of the church. Now, later, after this was the architect's design, which was approved, but Spurgeon later spoke against and decided to do away with the towers, so that's what was actually built, because he said they couldn't justify those ornate towers. He didn't think that that served any purpose for the gospel, so he got rid of those and rather than put the money into books. And the Metropolitan Tabernacle, here you can see the interior of it, the lower platform. He would have preached from the upper platform there. The baptismal tank is underneath inside. Proposals to build a new church was agreed on in 1858. At Spurgeon's request, its design was to be in a Greek style, for Greek is the sacred tongue in which the New Testament had been revealed. When the Metropolitan Tabernacle was opened in March 1861, it was the largest place of worship for dissenters in the land, seating over 5,000 people. Unprecedented that a non-state church could have a congregational meeting place so big. Here you can see, if they moved away the platform and the table, the baptismal tank was right below the pulpit in the front of the Metropolitan Tabernacle. So there you get a full view of how it was from outside through to in. 5,000 seater. At first there's no organ, and a man with a tuning fork led the singing, and most of Spurgeon's congregation were lower middle class, and the congregation was evenly divided between males and females. Here you've got the first words of Spurgeon at the tabernacle, and this is in a plaque at the Metropolitan Tabernacle. "I would propose that the subject of the ministry in this house, as long as this platform should stand, and as long as this house shall be frequented by worshippers, shall be the person of Jesus Christ. I am never ashamed to avow myself a Calvinist. I do not hesitate to take the name of Baptist. But if I'm asked what is my creed, I reply, it is Jesus Christ. My venerated predecessor, Dr. Gill, has left a body of divinity admirable and excellent in its way. But the body of divinity to which I would pin and bind myself forever, God helping me, is not his system, or any other human treatise, but Christ Jesus, who is the sum and substance of the gospel, who is in himself all theology, the incarnation of every precious truth, the all-glorious personal embodiment of the way, the truth, and the life." And this card was produced also after his death and distributed widely. Every person who joined this huge congregation was personally interviewed by Spurgeon, who wanted to ensure that each candidate's conversion was genuine. And he ran his congregation with a firm hand, it is said. But he endured intense opposition. Here's a picture in the local newspapers of Spurgeon, like Gulliver, being pinned down by lots of lesser people who tying him down with attacks and so on his character. During his early years in London, Spurgeon received intense slander and scorn. He wrote of a devastating bitterness of soul. He wavered between rejoicing in the persecutions he received and being utterly crushed by it. He wrote of being the laughing stock of fools and the song of the drunkard. But he was the greatest preacher of his age. During his lifetime, Spurgeon is estimated to have preached to 10 million people face to face. The theme for Spurgeon's Sunday morning sermon was usually not chosen until Saturday night, and the Sunday evening sermon was normally prepared on Sunday afternoon. And he spoke at a rate of 140 words per minute for an average of 40 minutes. Including funerals, weddings, and other invitations, Spurgeon often preached 10 times a week. And before he was 20, Charles had preached over 600 times. No PA system. The only way it could be done was by having a great ability to project your voice. And also, the architecture was always designing the buildings to try and be as acoustically supportive as possible. You'll notice a lot of the pulpits in those days had these sounding boards behind that would help to project. And these days, when we have curtains behind, curtains are very bad. They absorb sound. They don't project it. So they need PA systems today, also because many people are weak-voiced. Spurgeon, I remember one of my textbooks at college was Lectures to My Students by C.H. Spurgeon. One of the quotes in there was, Spurgeon says, if you don't have strong lungs and a strong voice, You haven't been called to preach. And these days you can get a person in a small congregation stumped because there's something wrong with the electrics and the PA system, and the whole service comes to an absolute standstill because they're trying to get the acoustics together. How did Whitfield and the Apostle Paul manage? You know, goodness me.
Outside,
yes, with hostile hecklers, and they could still preach over it. So I think many of our preachers today have become wimps, where the microphone has made people sort of whisper and make a little point. So Spurgeon was obviously not like that. Imagine preaching 60 times, 600 times before he reached 20. He typically read 6 books a week, and he could remember what he had read and where even years later. He built up an awesome personal library containing 12,000 volumes, 1,000 of which had been printed before the year 1700. Classic time of the Puritans back in the 1600s. And this is just one of his libraries. I mean, he had his office at the church, he had his one home in London, he had another home up in the country. So he had these massive libraries all around, but it came to 12,000 books at the end. Overwhelmingly Puritan works. Spurgeon's Sunday sermons were delivered extemporaneously with seldom more than a one-page outline before him. And here's some of the examples of single outlines. And these sermons were taken down in shorthand by a secretary who was appointed by the congregation, very far-sighted congregation, and we all blessed to this day because of him. And on Monday morning he'd revise the notes that were taken by the secretary and improve on a sermon, I presume, and then the sermon would be published by Thursday. Translated into several languages, even sold as far field as Australia and America, although the American editors cut out all of his comments against slavery, because that was considered too controversial at that stage. In 1865, Spurgeon's sermons were selling 25,000 copies a week, and these were translated into more than 20 languages. Spurgeon's sermons were issued weekly until 1917, by which time sales had totaled over 100 million copies. I mean, there's nothing to compare with that in the history of the world. It's just a phenomenal unpress. Imagine newspapers printing whole sermons. The kind of newspapers we know today that, you know, if they print one verse of the Bible, we somehow feel pleased. Testing the acoustics in the vast agricultural hall, Spurgeon shouted, "Behold the Lamb of God who takes away the sins of the world." Just that. And a worker high in the rafters of the building heard this and became converted to Christ as a result. One of the more effective sermons preached in a sentence. He is without a doubt the most prolific Christian author of all time. This is his main office and his secretary and where he worked on most of his notes and books and commentaries. Throughout his ministry, Spurgeon proved to be a prolific writer. He edited a monthly magazine, Sword and Trowel. Here's the first edition, first cover of the Sword and Trowel, sold for 3p, published by Paternoster Row. And it comes, of course, from Nehemiah, the book of Nehemiah, where they worked with a sword in one hand and a trowel in the other. So a tool and a sword. The point is, you've got to work and fight. And that's the magazine. It's still being printed and published, by the way, from Metropolitan Tabernacle to this day.
That's an interesting script underneath the sword and trowel.
A record of combat with sin and labor for the Lord.
Yeah.
Combat with sin and labor for the Lord. Yes, isn't it? That just gives you the whole picture. You can see they're alert for the enemy. They've got the trumpet there in hand. They're busy building. But the sword is right there, even while they are building. Sword and trowel. He also wrote several books and commentaries, produced sermon notes and lecture notes for his students, which is a textbook in colleges to this day. Charles Haddon Spurgeon is historically the most widely read preacher, aside from biblical ones like Paul and John, of course. Today there's more material available written by Charles Spurgeon than any other Christian author living or dead. Here's just one of his books, John Plowman's pictures, more of his talk. Now this, you can just see how the covers of his books were well illustrated, very advanced for that time, making use of interesting graphics. The new Park Street pulpit and the Metropolitan Tabernacle pulpit, the collected sermons of Spurgeon, fill 63 volumes. Here they are. That is equivalent to, that's over 20 million words, equivalent to 27 volumes of the Encyclopedia Britannica. A whole lot more edifying too. Spurgeon's sermon series stand out as the largest set of books by any single author in the history of Christianity. You just think of all the books produced by Schaeffer, Calvin, but Spurgeon outdoes them all in terms of sheer volume. At least three of Spurgeon's works, including the multi-volumed Metropolitan Tabernacle Pulpit series, have sold more than 1 million copies. One of these three bestsellers, All of Grace, was the first book ever published by Moody Press and is still their all-time bestseller. And I think we've got All of Grace next door as well. But he spent 20 years studying the book of Psalms and writing his commentary on them. The Treasury of David is considered his greatest work. And he considered the Treasury of David his greatest work in terms of writing as well. Now here's a few of the profiles of famous people at the time of Charles Spurgeon. You can see, for example, Gladstone, the Prime Minister, Charles Spurgeon smack in the middle. You could see some of the other people there who'd probably be less known. John Ruskin, the musician. Charles Spurgeon drew to his service as the Prime Minister William Gladstone, members of the Royal Family, members of Parliament, Florence Nightingale, General James Garfield, later President of the United States, American evangelist D.L. Moody, missionary David Livingstone. Commenting on Spurgeon's practice of working an average of 18 hours a day, Livingstone once asked him, "How do you manage to do two men's work in a single day?" And Spurgeon replied, "We have forgotten there are two of us." And here you can see a contemporary picture of Queen Victoria with some of the great minds of her time. And there's Charles Spurgeon depicted by people, along with a whole lot of individuals that many of whom, you can see General Charles Gordon, for example, many of the famous people of that time. But Spurgeon is there as the most prominent preacher of Queen Victoria, and she's got a Bible in her hand sitting by the fireplace. Some of the famous contemporaries and friends of Livingstone that we would immediately recognize would include Hudson Taylor and George Muller. Spurgeon often met with the China Inland Mission founder, Hudson Taylor, and the famous founder of orphanages, the German George Muller. Charles paid several visits to Ashley Down, Bristol, to talk with a heavenly-minded man, as he called him, George Muller. He was astounded by Muller's stories of living by faith. And Charles once said that if he could have changed bodies with anyone, it would be with George Muller for both time and eternity. They often spent whole days together, stimulating one another's faith by discussing the unfailing promises of God. George Muller, you may recall, was the founder of orphanages who would not do normal fundraising techniques that was common at that time. He was a faith missionary, and he planted these orphanages. There were times that they all gathered, and they gave thanks for the food, and there wasn't a stick of food on the table or in the kitchen. And after Amen, there'd be a knock on the door, and there would be the baker's carters being trapped by the snow and couldn't get any further, and said, "Well, would you like this bread?" And things like that. Amazing provisions. When in 1867 Charles was offered £20,000, which would be a phenomenal amount of money. I mean, even now that would be a lot, but back in that time, you can just imagine the value of it when an average soldier was paid a shilling at that stage, a day as a salary. You can imagine what £20,000 was. He immediately suggested to the donor that it should rather be given to George Muller. But the donor insisted that Spurgeon must keep this gift and must start this orphanage himself. And this launched him on his famous orphanage ministry, which he carefully patterned upon Muller's. William Gladstone was four times the Prime Minister of England. He visited the tabernacle and was criticized for receiving this dissenting preacher, Charles Spurgeon, for lunch and breakfast at 10 Downing Street on a number of occasions. What is he, the Prime Minister of the realm, doing having a dissenter in the Prime Minister's residence? But Gladstone was described as a man of principle and a man of prayer. He is educated at Eton and Oxford. He became a Conservative Member of Parliament for Newark, and his first important speech called for the emancipation of slaves. He went way back to that part of the century. Another one of the contemporaries is Lord Shaftesbury, who's famous for all that he did to bring alleviation for the poor. The 7th Earl of Shaftesbury was 33 years Spurgeon's senior, but they became firm friends. They corresponded frequently. They met at Spurgeon's London home. and at his holiday home in the south of France. Spurgeon described Lord Shaftesbury as a real nobleman and a man of God. And Shaftesbury became president of one of the missions associated with Spurgeon's tabernacle, the one administered to street vendors. It was Lord Shaftesbury who chaired Spurgeon's 50th birthday celebrations in the tabernacle, and Spurgeon was present at Shaftesbury's 80th birthday celebrations. Lord Shaftesbury was tireless and compassionate on behalf of the poor, and he greatly improved the working conditions of women and children in the mines and the factories. He also supported many foreign missions. William Booth of the Salvation Army was also converted in his teens, and he also became a worker for the Lord within days of his conversion. So there was a similarity also between him and Spurgeon, although only in a few points. Spurgeon supported William Booth's holy activities, and he commended him for stirring the masses of London. And Spurgeon had William Booth lecture at his pastor's college, and William Booth invited Spurgeon to minister at his mission hall in Whitechapel. So again, there was a working relationship between these great men of faith. Even though William Booth was very Arminian, let it be said. So they were on different ends of the spectrum theologically, but they loved one another's work and support one another anyway. D.L. Moody from America is another contemporary who, arriving on England for the first time in 1867, this American evangelist D.L. Moody made straight for the tabernacle and sat in the gallery. And when back home and people asked if he had seen various tourist sites or the cathedrals, Moody responded, "No, but I've heard Spurgeon." And D.L. Moody wrote that heaven came down on his soul and he returned to America a better man for having heard Spurgeon preach. Now, in spite of Moody's Arminian views, he invited the staunch Calvinist Charles Spurgeon to preach at his Moody and Sankey crusades in Bow Road Hall. And Spurgeon also invited Moody to preach at the tabernacle at his Jubilee celebrations in 1884. Both Moody and Spurgeon founded colleges and both began their Christian work amongst children. So, interesting comparisons, even though, again, theologically they were on opposite ends of the spectrum. Now, this was his first pastor's college, although it moved to bigger premises later. Although Charles Spurgeon trained many pastors, he himself received no theological training. He related an incident where a servant girl had inadvertently shown him into the wrong room and he missed the principal, who he had an appointment to have an interview with, who was waiting in the next room. But later he determined not to reapply for admission to college, believing that God had spoken to him, "Seekest thou great things for thyself? Seek them not." Well, Baptists had a long tradition of ordaining ministers, but Spurgeon managed to get his church to omit the step. He was never ordained. He campaigned arduously to do away with the customary title reverend and eventually succeeded in replacing it with pastor, one of the first to do so. To further the work of the gospel, Spurgeon established his pastor's college at Camberwell. And this is one of the lecture rooms that Spurgeon would have lectured his students in at that college. And he made himself responsible for a weekly lecture there, and he published his notes and lectures to my students, which remains a major textbook in Baptist colleges to this day. These are four of the first lecturers at Spurgeon's College, not that it was called Spurgeon's College at that time. And here you can see some of the ministers at the college with C.H. Spurgeon sitting in the front row back in 1888. Nearly 900 students were trained at Spurgeon's College during his lifetime. And here's one of the graduating classes. If only students of colleges looked like that these days. I'm afraid they often look like they're on the way to the beach these days. But also his book, Spurgeon Lectures to My Students, was the compilation of all of his lecture notes through the years to his students. And this, in fact, was also my textbook at Theological College, and I still got on my shelf lots of great wisdom. About the time of his death, the college was renamed Spurgeon's College and relocated to South Norwood, and this is the college to this day. And it continues to be a successful college in England. And one of the things that was remarkable about Spurgeon's College is it welcomed people of any class with minimal educational background qualifications. Those who couldn't gain access to other colleges were welcome there if they were serious, because Spurgeon had a dislike for the state church, and he had a great suspicion for those who put academics too high, and he wanted to be sure that evangelism and good doctrine was at the heart of things. So he just like Hudson Taylor allowed anybody to apply to the mission, didn't have the same high hoops for them to jump over that many of the other missions had at that time. And China Inland Mission pioneered the way of opening the door and saying, we're wide open to laymen coming into our mission, which was quite revolutionary at that time. Sir Spurgeon did the same thing, that he was allowing people with minimal educational qualifications to apply to his college. Of course, it was still very much on merit. And this is a picture of the remarkable Stockwell Orphanage. I don't know if you realised how big the orphanages were that Spurgeon was responsible for. And this is just one of them. But notice the chapel right up front. Very prominent by the gates. Very well run. Very professional. In 1866, a gift of £20,000 enabled him to found an orphanage at Stockwell, providing a home and education for 500 homeless boys and girls. And this is just the boys' hostels at Stockwell Orphanage. He also believed in the power of literature, of course, and one of the themes was Bibles for Britain. In the same year they formed the orphanage, he formed the Colportage Association to give country people the opportunity to buy Christian books and Bibles at low cost. In one year alone, his 96 colporters sold 23,000 Bibles. His book fund provided multitudes of pastors with resources for biblical preaching. So here's just some of his colporters. Again, very respectably dressed people. And these would be the ones going around with a cart selling Bibles in very rural areas and other Christian books. And this is the depot buildings where the literature's on the shelves and they're coming in to rearm for going out on the next literature evangelism foray. He was always a centre of controversy. Charles Spurgeon was a man of strong convictions and he was often a centre of controversy. Although he was an eloquent and persuasive speaker, he was not a good debater, it is said. And he paid a heavy price, both emotionally and physically, for his involvement in controversies, both the theological controversies and the political controversies. The German theologian Helmut Thielicke declared, "Sell all that you have and buy Spurgeon," meaning buy his books. But many preachers condemned Spurgeon's doctrine and delivery. And criticizing his Puritan faith, one pastor asked Spurgeon how could he reconcile his Calvinist theology with his fervent evangelism. And Spurgeon responded, "I don't try to reconcile friends." Well, he's in the middle of theological and political controversies. The Prime Minister, William Gladstone, was Spurgeon's political hero. Here you can see a caricature in the newspaper showing Spurgeon right in the forefront of the brain of the Prime Minister, William Gladstone. Well, from the 1860s to 1880, Spurgeon was an ardent political dissenter, active on behalf of Gladstone's party. And he would openly denounce Disraeli's policies. That's, Disraeli was the opponent, sometime Prime Minister of England. Disraeli was the one who betrayed, for example, Charles Gordon and didn't send support to him in Khartoum. And it's because of that that he came crashing down and Gladstone came to the fore. And, of course, Spurgeon was involved in preaching out against Disraeli frequently for his cowardly policies and foreign policies which caused such havoc in Africa in particular, thinking how Disraeli betrayed both Charles Spurgeon, Charles Gordon, and got the whole Zulu War going and all sorts of other nonsense that they didn't like. So he would hand out handbills in support of Gladstone's party and church, and yet when Gladstone supported Home Rule for Ireland, Spurgeon withdrew support and split from his lifelong friend William Gladstone. Spurgeon declared Home Rule means Rome Rule. To give Home Rule to Ireland is to basically hand over Ireland to Catholicism. And there could be no compromise with the papacy in Rome. The martyrs who'd been burned to death at Smithfield compelled him to resist. And in this way, he epitomizes exactly what Ian Paisley has been stating all these years as well. So it's not surprising that Charles Spurgeon's pictures are up very prominently in the Martyrs Memorial Church in Belfast to this day. But that he would have turned from his lifelong friend on a matter of principle like this just shows how strongly he felt about Rome and tyranny, and he would not compromise with it. He was at the centre of a terrible theological controversy called the downgrade theology. About the same time that Gladstone's party split over Home Rule in Ireland, Spurgeon's opposition to liberalism split the Baptist Union. Many people had written to Spurgeon urging him to do something about the deteriorating situation in the Baptist Union with a spirit of modern biblical criticism. Liberalism was undermining the authority of the scriptures, denying the deity of Christ. Spurgeon wrote articles in his magazine, The Sword and Trowel, defending the Puritan tradition, attacking the enemies of our faith. Spurgeon criticized those who were giving up the atoning sacrifice, denying the inspiration of holy scriptures, and casting slurs upon justification by faith. Here's a picture of a group of Baptist ministers in England during the life of Charles Spurgeon. They look a respectable bunch of people, but amongst them were those who were pushing this new liberalism. The downgrade controversy, as it became known, pitted Baptist minister against Baptist minister and darkened Spurgeon's last years. The Baptist Union censured the most famous Baptist minister in the world, in all of history actually. At the Baptist Union Assembly of 1888, a large majority voted a censure against Charles Spurgeon, effectively excommunicating him. Some observers considered the Baptist Union had condemned the greatest, noblest, and grandest leader of the faith. However, Spurgeon rejected the suggestions of his friends that he start a competitive denomination. The downgrade controversy took its toll, and Spurgeon's health continued to deteriorate. In fact, many people believed he died a martyr to the faith as a result of this, because his life was cut short and his health just plummeted as a result of this controversy. He took these battles badly. But in his last years, he suffered from such a sense of isolation, he declared, "Scarcely a Baptist minister of standing will know me." But multitudes still came to hear him preach, and his actions strengthened the conservative wing in the Baptist Union, that they were able to make a comeback later. All in all, the verdict is Spurgeon was unsurpassed. He never claimed to be a theologian. He was a gospel preacher, and in that he was unsurpassed both in his day and since. Charles Spurgeon combined old-fashioned biblical doctrine with up-to-date preaching methods. He had an uncanny ability to sense the pulse of his times, and he knew how to reach out to ordinary and troubled people in a way that they could understand, a way they could respond to. He spoke the language of the marketplace. He spoke it humorously. He spoke it with common sense. And he spoke it with compelling power. Spurgeon described his approach to preaching, "I take my text and I make a beeline to the cross." He described saving faith as an immediate relation to Christ, accepting, receiving, and resting upon him alone for justification, sanctification, and eternal life by virtue of the covenant of grace. He later wrote, "Our warfare is with men who are giving up the atoning sacrifice, denying the inspiration of Holy Scripture, casting slurs on justification by faith." This is one of his most famous sermons, "Compel Them to Come In," which is believed to be one of his finest sermons. When Spurgeon took a text, he took it seriously and he used it to point people to Christ. And people were amazed at how he could preach on one text and just go through the whole sermon on one half of a verse. And to this day, at the moment, our family, we're reading through Morning by Evening, where Spurgeon's got one verse, just a phrase out of a verse, and all the riches that he pulls out of it. It's an extraordinary gift that the man has, but he plainly got it because he read the works of the Puritans as a young boy, and that of course shaped him for life. Spurgeon's sermons came to be published in the Monday editions of the London Times and even the New York Times. Can you imagine the New York Times publishing Spurgeon's sermons? Of course, they're the same newspapers that criticized him initially, but later they realized our readers want to hear this, so they gave the readers what they wanted. And occasionally Spurgeon had to ask members of his congregation not to attend next Sunday service, that newcomers might find a seat. I mean, that's pretty unusual, that pastors are pleading with the congregation not to come to church. He was a man of God. Now here, somebody put together some of the things he wrote, and you can see here all titles of books he's produced: Types and Gardens, Evening by Evening, Treasury of David, All of Grace, My Sermon Notes, and Commentaries and Lectures to My Students, and all of the different things, John Plowman Talk, and Morning by Morning, and The Interpreter, and Flashes of Thought, and all of this there, Feathers for Arrows. So these are just different titles of great books and works that he produced. And this was produced by some of the people at the Metropolitan Tabernacle, saying, "A truer heart never beat, a kinder friend never mustered unto another's need, a tongue whose living words ring over every land, while widows, orphans, students, friends, a loving friends, a loving friend, cry heaven's speed. So I think this was produced shortly after his death. Charles Spurgeon was a man of God. He was a man of prayer. He was a man of the word. He diligently studied. He read avidly. He broke with traditions. He broke with conventions. He became the greatest communicator of his age. Devoted to the scriptures, to disciplined prayer, to godly living, Spurgeon exemplified Christian commitment when he stood in the pulpit, and this gave power to his preaching. They knew that he lived what he preached and he meant what he said. But the one thing he lacked was good health. He constantly suffered from ailments and he fell into serious depressions at times. Yet he overcame his physical limitations and the relentless criticisms to be established as the greatest preacher in an age of great preachers. I mean, this is an age of the Livingstons and the Deal Moody's, and to think that Spurgeon, in an age of great preachers, could have stood out so much. Once, while laid low by illness, he declared, "It is a great trial to be unable to preach in the pulpit, but it is no small comfort to be able to preach through the printing press." Now, he believed in the power of the printed page as well as the preached word. Spurgeon wrote, "If ministers of the gospel, instead of giving lectures and devoting so much time to literary and political pursuits, would preach the word of God and preach it as if they were pleading for their own lives, then, my brethren, we might expect better success." Here's one of the last photos of his life, Charles Spurgeon at the south of France, recuperating from his last bout of illness, which was the end of his earthly ministry. Spurgeon's theology can be summed up as "I hold and am held." Spurgeon's theology was radically biblical. Here's a copy of one of his Bibles. "It has been my earnest endeavor ever since I've preached the word never to keep back a single doctrine which I have believed to be taught of God. If God teaches it, it is enough. If it's not in the word, away with it." It is well known that Charles Spurgeon was a Calvinist. He went against the contemporary trend of abandoning and even denouncing Calvinism. At that stage, the trend was to move to Arminianism and away from Calvinism, and he went the opposite direction. He went back to the Puritans, back to the Calvinists, back to the Reformation with zeal and enthusiasm. And when the new Metropolitan Tabernacle was opened in 1861, his first series of sermons was on the five points of Calvinism. Those were the first five sermons he preached in. So he made it quite clear where he stood. He believed in sanctification. This, by the way, is the vestry in the Metropolitan Tabernacle. And this is the prayer room, which he called the powerhouse of the church. He took people down. It was called the ladies' room, but this is where most of the prayer meetings took place while he was preaching. Spurgeon taught a strong doctrine of sanctification, but he was quite scathing about perfectionism, which is what Wesley and William Booth taught, mind you. "Although they persuade themselves that their sins are dead, it is highly probable that the rest of the sins are only keeping out of the way to let their pride have room to develop to ruinous proportions." So he was not convinced about the fact that we could be perfect this side of the grave, but he did teach a strong doctrine of sanctification on earth too. He held to the Puritan hope. As far as eschatology goes, Charles Spurgeon shared the Puritans' post-millennial eschatology of hope, that the Great Commission would be fulfilled before the return of Christ, as Ian Murray's book, The Puritan Hope, well documents too. But when he was asked to describe himself, when people asked him concerning his theology, he responded he would like to be thought of as a mere Christian, echoing C.S. Lewis's words to come in the next century. He said, "I am never ashamed to avow myself a Calvinist. I do not hesitate to take the name of Baptist. But if I'm asked what my creed is, I reply, it is Jesus Christ." His last words at the tabernacle were, "If you wear the livery of Christ, you will find him so meek and lowly of heart that you will find rest unto your souls. He is the most magnanimous of captains. There never was his like among the choicest of princes. He is always to be found in the thickest part of the battle. When the wind blows cold, he always takes the bleak side of the hill. The heaviest end of the cross lies across his shoulders. If he bids us carry a burden, he carries it also. If there's anything that is gracious, generous, kind, and tender, yea, lavish and superabundant in love, you always find it in him. His service is life, peace, and joy. Oh, that you would enter on it at once. God help you to enlist under the banner of Jesus Christ." Those were his last preached words at the tabernacle. And this is his corner in the French place where they sent him to the south of France where he could recuperate, they hoped. And his bedroom shortly after he had died, they filled it with flowers. And his transport normally to the tabernacle. But the funeral cortege at Mentone railway station when he's being sent from France back to England, the olive casket at the tomb at Norwood Cemetery, and some of the masses of crowds, over 100,000 people turned up for the funeral. That's five services at the Metropolitan Tabernacle, and people needed tickets for that. An open Bible at the memorial for Charles Spurgeon, most appropriate, an open Bible. And this is the monument at Norwood Cemetery. But the real memorials are at the Stockwell Orphanage. This is the orphanage that still operates to this day. And the library at Regent's Park College. One of the books we have here is Spurgeon, Heir of the Puritans, by Ernest Bacon. Some of the other books I can recommend. The Life and Works of Reverend Charles Spurgeon, printed in 1892, very rare. The Saint and the Saviour, written by Charles Spurgeon, Morning by Morning and Evening by Evening by Charles Spurgeon. Those are classics of his for daily readings. John Plowman's talk, and of course, The Treasury of David, an exposition of the Psalms. Absolutely the best exposition of Psalms ever produced.